It's Wednesday, November 20th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Prince Andrew sits down for an interview with the BBC to talk about his involvement with Jeffrey Epstein. We'll also talk about the chilling of a long-standing rivalry and how a collaboration between the journalism schools here at Mizzou and KU is bringing new life to local reporting just the other side of the state line. And Kathy and I will tell you about a trip we made down to Missouri's Boot Heel and the special place that region holds in journalism history. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with John Solomon, his columns, his punditry, and what's been happening in the past week or so at The Hill. Kathy, help set this one up for us. It's a slightly different angle on what's been going on with the impeachment hearings.
Well, a reporter is at the center of this contretemps, and John Solomon's a longtime Washington fixture. He's worked for a lot of news organizations, and he did a lot of the stories that it now appears the president was relying on or citing to bolster his theory that Ukraine was at the center of election fraud, not as just about everybody else in the world seems to think, Russia. And as a result of that, so this comes out of Solomon did some interviews with people who are now infamous associates of Rudy Giuliani, and aired some of this both on Hill TV, which is their video version, and as well as wrote stories for the paper. And The Hill, we should say, is a little but powerful paper. It is one of two papers that really covers Capitol Hill. It circulates all across the Hill. It's seen in a lot of congressional offices. And one way you know how much punch they have, a lot of defense contractors buy advertising in The Hill. So a lot of people in this region of the country may not have heard of it, but it's well known in Washington. So it's influential, and because Solomon wrote these stories for it that are now, part of the reason that the president was so caught up in this theory, he is under a lot of scrutiny.
There's a review going on now into some of these articles that they're being annotated, they're being corrected, is there any benefit in doing that, or is toothpaste out of the can?
Well, I think for The Hill's reputation, definitely. You know, we've all known and talked about news organizations that have had a reason subsequent to publication to question a reporter's veracity, and they go back and do due diligence. So I think that's what's going on here. The Hill is trying to make up for any errors or omissions of fact-checking, and that's all about reputation. I think in terms of the damage and how much John Solomon had to do with this, I think is open to question, but it's not, doesn't look good for us reporters.
I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, he's now left The Hill, he's part of the political punditry on Fox News. I mean, that sort of lends itself to some of the criticism that's coming toward The Hill from mainstream news organizations, as well as from members of Congress who had once looked at The Hill, as you described, as a place where you could go to get information about what was going on Capitol Hill, and thus the various lobbying groups, as defense contractors and others.
It is a trade.
But now, I mean, he's moved on, mm-hmm. but that scrutiny is now on the paper. So every reporter, every writer, every editor who works for that paper is now having to deal with the aftermath of what transpired during the time that he was there.
Yeah, and I think one of the links that you put on the blog cites a member of Congress saying, telling a reporter for The Hill,
"I don't talk to anyone from The Hill anymore."
And so that, I think, is the reputational problem that the paper has to rectify or try to rectify. This goes really to a problem that we've talked about in other contexts here, and that is the diminishing borderline between commentary and news reporting. And so I think this is part of the trust problem that our industry has to address. We don't have things that are labeled. People who are getting things online don't get to see that it's on the op-ed page or it's in a section that's reserved for opinion. And so we have to be better about labeling those things, and also I think more vigilant in making sure that we as reporters separate our functions. There's one thing to report the facts and go cover the hearing and tell people what happened. It's another to introduce commentary or really become what it looks like here. John Solomon became a propagandist.
Okay. So here is a fun fact I'm guessing few people realize. The Stars and Stripes, the military newspaper, it has a very rich history that started right here in Missouri.
As a young soldier, it kept me entertained. I could find out what was going on at in my state of Missouri or in my country.
People who are familiar with Stars and Stripes are surprised to find out it started near the Missouri Boot Heel in a small town during the Civil War. First edition was published in Bloomfield, Missouri on a printing press that had been abandoned by the editor, who was a Southern sympathizer.
One of the Bloomfield legends, I picked it up for my family, for my neighbors.
Union troops commandeered the printing press and brought out the first edition of Stars and Stripes on November 9th, 1861, under the command of Ulysses Grant.
So, Kathy, you were one of the producers of that video. The entire thing is available on our Links blog. And the story behind the video is as incredible as the story that's in the video. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what's fascinating, you saw Brian Brooks, one of our emeritus professors in that video, and who really knows a lot about the history of this. He's written a piece about it for Gateway Media Review, which is a Midwest media review. And really what happened here is, as he says, Ulysses Grant's troops came into that area of the state. They wanted to take Cape Girardeau because it commands the Mississippi River. And to do that, they had to kind of go behind and around a military maneuver. And in the process, they captured this little town of Bloomfield, which had a printing press. It turns out that some of Grant's troops were printers. And so they started Stars and Stripes. And that was a tradition that continued because first, General Pershing, who commanded the American Expeditionary Forces in World War I, was a Missouri native. And he knew the story, and he knew that this newspaper had been a great morale booster for the Union troops. So he started it back up in World War I for the troops then. And then Dwight Eisenhower, who was the general in command of the World War II forces, knew the same story and started back again. And what's cool about this story is this is a newspaper that was started for the troops. It's published by the Pentagon, but it is completely independent of the Pentagon. And there's a great story about the Stars and Stripes Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Bill Malden, who irked General Patton during World War II because he drew GIs that were scruffy. And Patton wanted to court-martial him or discipline him in some way, and Eisenhower said, no, this is for the troops. You can't interfere. So I think what's really interesting about this is wherever American troops have gone, we have carried with us one of our great American values, which is freedom of speech and freedom of the press. So it's a great thing. Bloomfield got its first copy of an original edition when a guy found this in renovating an attic. And he wanted some money for this and called the Smithsonian Museum. And the Smithsonian doesn't pay for acquisitions. Mm-hmm. And so he called Bloomfield and said, would you like it? And they looked in their exchequer, and they were $50 shy of his asking price, which was $250. And so Jim Mayo, the other guy you saw in that video, fronted the $50, and that started this whole museum. So it's an amazing story about American values and community and how they worked so hard to get this in place.
And so we made this trip down to Cape Girardeau Saturday night, where there was a fundraiser specifically for the museum to try and really establish that into something special as well.
Yeah, I mean, the museum's a victim of its own success. Mm-hmm. You know, what has happened is a lot of stripers, as they call themselves, veterans of this publication, have brought all kinds of memorabilia and historical artifacts to the museum, and they need more space and more climate-controlled space. So it's a great cause.
Okay. Saturday night, well, let's put time zones into effect, but Saturday night while we were celebrating the Stars and Stripes, BBC Newsnight viewers got a shock. It was a rare sit-down interview with Prince Andrew. He went on the program to talk about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, explaining his decision to stay in Epstein's home and allegations that Prince Andrew had engaged in sex with minors arranged by Epstein.
Do you remember dancing at Tramp?
No, that couldn't have happened because the date that is being suggested, I was at home with the children.
You know that you were at home with the children. Mm. Was it a memorable night?
On that particular day that we now understand is the date, which is the 10th of March, I was at home. I was with the children. I'd taken Beatrice to a Pizza Express in Woking for a party at, sort of 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Why would you remember that so specifically? Why would you remember a Pizza Express birthday and being at home?
Because going to Pizza Express in Woking is an unusual thing for me to do. A very unusual thing for me to do. I've only been to Woking a couple of times, and I remember it weirdly distinctly. But as soon as somebody reminded me of it, I went, oh yes, I remember that.
So apparently it's an unusual thing for a prince in Britain to take their daughters to pizza parties. One of the headlines on one of the British publications, it's actually on our links blog, said that watching this interview was like watching a plane crash into an oil tanker. Like, that was just one of several surreal moments that left people wondering why he would even do this interview in the first place.
Yeah, I thought it was unusual of him to do the interview, and I completely understand how those who follow the BBC, and particularly those who are in Great Britain, would just sort of be in awe that this took place and talking about it as much as they have. What I find a little bit, you know, to be a little bit unusual is why we in the States seem to care so much about that. I mean, you know, we seem to be fascinated with the royals more than I think we should be. But that's just my own personal opinion. What I think we, you know, those of us in the States are concerned about is we keep hearing these stories about the prince and others who were involved with Jeffrey Epstein, and that closure part just for the victims, we haven't moved into that phase yet, because it's like we keep getting more and more information about this person who's engaged with them or this person who's involved with him. Harvard is now doing a more full investigation as to how much money he has donated to them and what they're using it for, whether or not they should keep it. And other institutions are doing the same. So we still have all of this going on, and the victims are like, but what about us? Mm-hmm. And we haven't gotten to that part yet.
Well, I will say, I completely agree with Ernest about, like, why do we care about the royals? Because, as you said before we went on air, didn't we fight a revolution to get rid of this stuff? But I think in this case, you nailed it when you said it's really about the victims. And I think with Epstein being dead, going after his associates is one way to try to get justice for these people. And I think what impressed me about the interview was the reporter's presence of mind to say, why did that stand out to you? And that produced what I thought was really a damning moment, not just because of the incredulity it incites, mm-hmm. but also the idea And I think this gets into the whole idea of entitlement and why the victims need to be somehow compensated. The idea that if you're rich or you're royal, and to you going to a pizza shop would
it's
be
so
an unusually memorable experience.
Memorable.
Right. Yeah, that if you are fit into those categories, somehow you don't have to play by the rules. And that's clearly what was going on here. So I think to the extent that that can be called out and called out as wrong, and that people who engage in that kind of behavior and that privilege can be brought down a peg or two, it might help the victim some.
Yeah, you talked about the interviewer and her presence of mind. I watched this, and I felt like it was eerily similar to watching the Gayle King R. Kelly interview, mm-hmm. that she sat there very calmly mm-hmm. in a very controlled tone of voice. And she actually continued to give him the space to further step in it mm-hmm. and to make his own situation worse.
I mean, I think she was definitely prepared for the mm-hmm. interview. She knew what questions she wanted to ask. And she actually, as you said, mm-hmm. she gave him the space to talk, but she was also listening, and she was listening for key things that he was saying. And then she would come back at him and say, well, wait a minute, but what about this? Or, how do you remember that so succinctly? I mean, and if you aren't prepared and you aren't listening, you miss that opportunity. And I think that was what made the interview so powerful.
I think it's a great point, and a great point for journalists to keep in mind, that no matter how outrageous the story is or how outrageous your interview subject, that you really need to keep your emotions in check, and that by being professional and not letting any righteous anger show, but just by being a cool, poised professional, you really can do a better job than you could if you let outrage and emotion pour out of you.
Okay, so an Arkansas television reporter will start serving a 3-day jail sentence today after a judge found her in contempt of court for recording portions of a murder trial. The judge has signs posted outside his courtroom making it clear he doesn't allow recordings, but the reporter said she didn't see them and that having the audio aided in her note-taking, leading to more accurate reporting. I read about this, and I read the station's response, which you can see on our links blog, and I really found myself in a place of mixed feelings, mixed emotions, that I see and I support the need for the transparency of being able to record in a courtroom, have cameras, have audio recordings, but there were rules that were there in place, and she didn't follow them, and there are consequences for that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I don't think the public really understands is that the courtroom mm-hmm. Is one of the few places left mm-hmm. where the judge is in control of everything in there. And in a majority of courtrooms in the United States, they control how that information gets in and out. They look at it as, you know, this is a part of the process to try to make sure that all sides have equal footing in the courtroom, and it's the judge's responsibility. And many of them will basically say, this is how information is going to be gathered and used by whoever in the courtroom. And so I know when I was covering court, the first thing that I would do as a reporter is I would always go to the judge's chamber and ask what were the rules that the judge set for how he operated in his courtroom and how he dealt with the press. And maybe in this instance, the reporter didn't do that. I do find it ironic that he is sentencing her to serve time in jail. I think that's a little extreme, mm-hmm. especially in light of the fact that none of what she had recorded saw its way into onto the air. And I think that's a little extreme.
Yeah, I think you can argue, and in an ideal world, yes, the reporter, it's incumbent on reporters to find out what the rules are. However, given the economics of the news business, as we've discussed here, oftentimes you're sending very young, inexperienced reporters into a situation where they may not have time to do the kind of due diligence that Ernest is talking about. And I think it's never a good look when a judge puts a reporter in jail for trying to do her job. I think the judge may have been righteously aggravated, but I think this doesn't really fit the crime. And, you know, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press maintains a handbook for reporters, and it's really hard to figure out what the rules are because, as Ernest says, in every courtroom, the judge is the king. Mm-hmm. And so judges just, and it's similar, having covered legislative bodies, similarly committee chairman, you walk into a room and you don't know, are you allowed to use a recorder? Are you not allowed to use a recorder? Can you stand up? Can you follow somebody out of the room? It varies. And so, you know, I think it behooves the courts to be a little more to try to do a better job of making these rules more uniform, and also to bring them up to the 21st century. Yeah. I mean, this reporter was just trying to be accurate. Yeah. She wasn't trying to capture a bite, a sound bite to broadcast. She was just trying to enhance her accuracy, and I would think most judges should support that.
You had mentioned something about bringing more uniformity into this. One of those other challenges, too, is you're talking about young reporters, is that this is an issue as it relates to state courts and state courts only, since federal courts don't have recordings at all, or cameras at least. So many, especially in television news, so many young reporters move and hop markets every 2 years or 3 years. Mm-hmm. That she's working in Arkansas now, when she worked in a different state a year or 2 years ago, it may have been different. And in her previous job before that may have been different too. So that's another one of those areas where there's another layer of perhaps a reason to understand or give benefit of the doubt that where the last time she covered a trial, it may have been perfectly okay to do.
Yeah. Right. And even within jurisdictions, yeah, it can vary. Different that's judges right. can set different rules, and you have municipal courts and state courts and then your federal courts. So you could be in the same city and have a different set of rules right. for three different trials.
And going back to what you were talking about in terms of what's happening financially and the fact that you don't have as many reporters and they're having to produce a lot more news than they previously had to do. You know, you're moving from one thing to the other, and you could easily forget, oh, wait a minute, I'm in this judge's mm-hmm. courtroom and he wants this, or, you know, now I'm in another judge's courtroom in another municipality or another city and she wants something different. I mean, it can be hard, which is why I don't understand why the judge didn't just say, okay, I understand you made a mistake.
Let's
have a conversation. We'll just let this go.
Okay. Well, tonight there's another Democratic presidential debate. We know that that's going to happen. But here's a debate that kind of may or may not and may give you a second to think. The chairman of FedEx is challenging the chairman of the New York Times to a debate on federal tax policy. It was a story he was upset about. The chairman of FedEx, he was upset about it and kind of sort of suggested that the two men take the fight outside.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times ran a story in their Sunday paper, which basically said that in the last, you know, tax mm-hmm. filings that FedEx went from paying billions of dollars in taxes to no taxes at all after the Trump tax cuts went into effect. And the CEO for FedEx was like, whoa, wait a minute, you know, you're wrong. We did this, we did that, but I want to challenge you to a debate to talk about federal tax policy. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, even if you have a cogent argument, you're still going to lose in the court of public opinion. There's no way you're going to be able to win that argument about the fact that you didn't do all these things that lowered your tax bill.
Just makes them look silly.
Makes you look silly, absolutely.
Yeah, and can you imagine what the audience would be for two executives get into a ring and argue about
two executives who
taxes?
Make billions of dollars.
Exactly, yeah. Billions of dollars. Well, okay, so when I was in school here back in the 90s, I was taught the best way to share a story was to show something, not necessarily tell that story. People need to see and experience stories, and that's what One Dallas Television Station is trying to accomplish with its newest series, Verify Road Trip. Here is an excerpt from one episode, What We Know About Climate Change and How We Know It.
I need to sense it, I need to feel it, I need to see it. You know, if it's happening, I need to be shown this is what's happening.
That's Justin. He's 38, a father of two, and a roofing contractor. Justin is politically conservative, and like most people in his social circle, he rejects the idea of climate change.
Hey! Hey, welcome in. How's it going?
David.
I'm Justin. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Together, we're going to explore three questions. One, is the climate changing abnormally?
No. Not from whenever I was a kid. I mean, my whole lifetime, I haven't seen anything different.
Two, are humans to blame?
I don't think so. I don't think that they can change what the world is doing.
And three, how urgent is this?
0 to 10, I think this climate change is probably a 3, due to it's just a pattern in time.
So, thoughts on this approach, taking somebody who completely does not believe in the science of climate change or some of the humanitarian issues of immigration, taking them out there to see it, experience it for themselves, meet with the experts, and document it. Your reaction to the approach?
It's an unusual approach. I mean, I would give the television station that's doing this, you know, some credit for trying to do it. But you know, are they going to change hearts and minds? That's going to be interesting to see. Are they going to help educate people? Probably so. They'll learn something from it. But again, if what is your goal here? Is your goal to sort of foster a conversation, a more civil conversation around these? If that's your goal, then I think it's worth it. If it's your goal is to try to change someone's heart and mind about whether or not climate change exists, whether or not the immigration policy that's currently enforced is good, that's the part where I think it gets a little tricky.
I think everybody's trying to figure out a way to do exactly what Erna said. And so it's great, but I think you have to be careful when you put interviews like that on the air that you contextualize them. I mean, just because this roofer thinks there's no climate change doesn't outweigh the opinions of the many, many experts who do.
It's an important point. We are a big school, and as faculty members, we all have projects that we work on every day that most of our colleagues don't know anything about. This is one, though, that's so cool, I wish I'd known about it from the start. Our colleague, Randy Smith, has teamed up with a faculty member from the Journalism School at the University of Kansas to help bring local news back to the small town of Eudora. For a lot of MU alumni, for a lot of MU sports fans, the idea of teaming up with KU is the worst thing that could ever happen. I think this is really cool, though. Randy Smith's Journalism in Chaos class, teaming up with Dr. Terry Finneman's class going on at KU, her class providing the editorial support for this publication, Randy Smith's looking at how to build the business model to have it be sustainable. It's a great way to bring sustainable journalism back into news deserts.
I think it's very good. Terry was one of my students when she was in the graduate program here, and you know, she has a reputation for trying innovative things. Randy, of course, is always looking at what's the best approach to try to monetize journalism in various places. So I think that's good. And these news deserts do exist. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important that we try very new and innovative ways to make this work. And if that means KU and MU has to get together to make it happen, then so be it.
Well, I think we're seeing signs of collaboration among rivals everywhere in the news business because necessity is forcing it. And I think it's a great thing that one of the really great ways to fill the vacuum is with students. We do it here at the university. We've done it for many years, and our news outlets have become more important as providers of news to the community as other news outlets have shrunk because of this financial crisis that we've talked about. So I think anything we can do to help communities regain those trusted news sources is a great mission for universities.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time for today. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Make sure that you're following us on Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle there is at Views on KBIA. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling our audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We're going to be off for a few weeks, but wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And we'll see you again on December 11th for another edition of Views of the News.